This is not a law. A law working class which on its own went as far as it possibly could. That is, accomplished. They accomplished the job that most people said could not be done. They organized the mass production industries in the industrial form of organizations, and that was as far as they could go at that given time on their own. Not because they didn't want to, and they wouldn't have gone further if they had. Not to matter with the religion, why the Socialist Workers' Party was only able to say in one city. Why were we only successful in the recent cities? Maybe not the same time. Why did we even do it then? Because we made it up in the other places in the country. Why was nobody there? I tell you what. We didn't get to know that. We didn't have a time. We were in the Socialist Party. In 1936, the period of the greatest upset, we were hamstrung by a party which did not even believe, the rebellion, the fraction of the organization. They rebelled the organization of offices against. Kaczynski, in our memory, considered himself a socialist. And the government was a socialist. Kaczynski was a socialist. And they didn't pay any money, did they? Kaczynski was a socialist. They were considered their people. Didn't that. But that is not as it is. No, not as far as much as I can say. And I think that the history will bear us out when we say that it was a question of leadership. Just as it was a question of leadership after the war in 1945 in France and England. Why didn't the workers take power in France and England? There was no. In Italy especially, there was nothing that would be involved with the hung Mussolini up by the heels and on our armpost. Well, there is no Italian ruling class in the house. So destructive, they all been identified with fascism. Why didn't the workers say come up? Because they're in the silence. That's why. And they have to meet themselves at Taylor and Walter and Casablanca and Moscow and have the best money. Cities around the country to maintain capitalism. Was it because the workers weren't prepared? No, the workers were prepared. They were lucky. Leadership couldn't. So I'm going to talk to you about the crisis of the century, the crisis of leadership, the crisis of the international crisis of leadership. And it's going to be different next time. So the first part is going to be a hell of a lot better than that, I can tell you. It's a hell of a lot better than that. And what are we for? And it's going to be infinitely better than that. And we're going to be number one.
Before time going into the next class, you are finished tonight's class and call everybody comes tomorrow at 1 o'clock here, let you know where to go to the end of the room. And I thank everyone for coming in. Please go back to the bookstore and browse through. Thank you.
Struggle through overturning capitalism and to establish a new socialist order. That has been called in question, you know, as I indicated last night, especially by some of the pundits of the new lefts. Contend that on the basis of experience of the past 3 decades, the only conclusion that they can come to is that the working class actually is part of the establishment, not a revolutionary factor in a changing society. I think I've demonstrated, to my satisfaction, if not to our satisfaction, that the contrary is true. That this American working class is very slow to move, but when it does move, it moves massively. And it's quite capable of defying its historical task. Now today we deal with another aspect of the problem. How do revolutionary Marxists, how does the party intervene in this process to most effectively facilitate and accelerate and hasten the ultimate outcome of the struggle? Deal with opposition formation, that is caucus formation, faction formations in the union, that is the building of a genuine left wing in the trade union movement, capable of not only of leading the workers, but in order to establish its position to lead the workers, it first has to deal with a very powerful, entrenched bureaucracy. That's the first task. How do we successfully carry on a struggle against this bureaucracy, which is an agency of imperialism within the working class movement, and a very powerful one at that? Now this has taken over the years, has taken many forms. At one stage in the development of the party, we adopted one tactic or another, depending upon what the objective circumstances were in which we operated, what the political climate was, relationship of forces in the union movement, the forces at our disposal, and the disposition of those forces, given the fact that we never have adequate forces, that is, adequate to meet our aspiration, but how to best utilize those we have at our disposal. Now, in his last work on the trade unions, entitled The Trade Unions in the Epoch of Imperialist Decay, Trotsky emphasized two major slogans for a revolutionary opposition within the trade union movement aimed at accomplishing a very definite task, that is transforming the unions from instruments of reaction to instruments of revolutionary struggle in conquest of workers' power. And these two were the struggle against the tendency on the part of the state to the growing together, process of growing together between the trade unions and the state. The increasing state intervention in the internal affairs of the union. Now we get into that in the discussion, and after the discussion in preliminary in a question over whether or not the Taft-Hartley Act constituted what I consider a turning point in the trade union movement, especially around this point. That is, when the employers found in the big 1946 strike that by their own resources they were incapable of coping with the power of the unions, they resorted to an appeal to the state to come to their aid. And the state did, that is the national federal government, in the adoption of the Taft-Hartley Act. And the Taft-Hartley Act has successfully prevented any growth of the unions from that period. The unions represent about 20 or 25% of the labor force now, and that's what they did then. There has been no growth in the trade unions since the enactment of Taft-Hartley. And of course, Taft-Hartley was then supplemented by Landrum Griffin and a number of other legislative, both on the state and national scale, legislative devices intended to prevent the unions from growing. And so the problem of the union movement today, and the problem at the time of the fusion between the FL and CIO, despite all the hopes and promises, was not a numerical increase in the size of the union movement, which would be meaningless. Another million workers organized into trade unions as they exist today would mean nothing. So far as the question of the growth and development of the influence of the trade unions in the social life of the country. What is required is a decisive change in policy, and only such a change could initiate a process of altering this unfavorable relation. And it would have to be political. There would have to be a complete political change in the policy of the trade unions. They would have to abandon the policy of coalition subordination to the Democratic Party and the organization of an independent working class party based upon the trade union. Now, in my presentation, I am going to, as much as possible, rely upon my own personal experiences with which I am more familiar than I am with the experiences of others, and from which we can derive probably a better understanding of what the task of the party is in relation to the union. Now the 1930s were a lot different than the 1970s. In more ways than one, and especially in this way, you see, in the sense that in the 1930s, for example, the Communist Party, the Stalinists, were a major factor in the trade union movement. You see, they controlled many CIO unions. They controlled many central labor bodies. They were a mass movement. And wherever you went to run, you ran back into the storm in the 1930s. And so a large part of our trip so-called liberal wing of the trade union bureaucracy. That aspect of the problem of the question, which played a very, very important role for us in the 30s, does not now exist. We have other problems. And so other problems require other solutions. In the 1930s, we entered into a block with the Lindbergh Group on the waterfront. Now, Lindbergh was a sailor who came out of the San Francisco strike in 1934. He was a picket captain in Seattle. He went into the question of the role that Seattle played in these subsequently their organization, our struggles on the waterfront in the Pacific Coast waterfront in 1954. He was a European syndicalist. He went to San Francisco. And there engaged in a struggle with the bureaucracy and defeated them on the basis of the tremendous upsurge of the seamen in the 1934 strike. They were able to topple what was then one of the most powerful bureaucratic expressions on the labor movement that we've ever seen. In fact, they were these bureaucrats were evicted not only from their office, but physically. They were actually kicked down the stairs of the Sailors Union Hall by the rank and file. So high was the feeling running against them and against what they call their executive board, which has sold out one strike after another, and which have reduced the Seamen's Union to a caricature. And Lundberg became head of the union. Now in the 1934 strike, the Seamen won nothing. That sounds anomalous, doesn't it? It was a run, it was a longshore strike, and the longshore settled the strike on conditions favorable to the longshoremen. They want a six-hour day, for example. They want joint control of the Highland Hall and a number of other demands. And when they won, they went back to work, but the seamen went back to work without an agreement. No contract. Nothing. Apparently. Except an organization. They, as I say, they had ousted the old bureaucracy, established a new leadership, and proceeded to impose conditions upon the union and upon the ship owners. That is, to the surprise of the ship owners, they found that unless a man came out of the union highway hall, he was not permitted aboard the ship, that's all. And if he got aboard the ship, sometimes they were unceremoniously dumped overboard. And a couple of those experiences convinced them that they had better ship union men out of the union, out of the hiring hall, if they wanted their ships to sail. Because sailors succeeded, along with the farming and of course succeeded in imposing their own terms of the agreement on the ship owners without any written, without any written contract. It was only in the 1936-37 strike, which was a seamen strike, that the seamen won a written contract, a written agreement, giving control of the hiring hall and whatever other concessions and demands they had advanced. But in 1936-37, in the midst of the strike, again, the government enacted the Merchant Marine Act of 1936. Now, the Merchant Marine Act of 1936 ostensibly was adopted by Congress and the administration in order to build an American Merchant Marine. The American Merchant Marine from the period of the First World War had deteriorated to the point where it was no longer effective as a merchant marine. And necessarily so, you see, because this country emerged from World War I as a creditor nation. It had gone into the war as a debtor nation. And one of the ways to which, one of the few ways in which they would even permit their debtors to pay off their debts was through services, that is, through transporting cargo in foreign bottoms. Foreign vessels. They wouldn't permit a large influx of commodities because that would then affect the owners of industry here. You have the same big problem today. The big problem about protectionism of the unions again. That was the big problem after World War I. Protection. How do you protect on the native clothing markets, you see, from the Hebrew label in Korea. They overlook the fact that Korea is a client state of the United States. Korea, South Korea couldn't exist without the support of the United States. And low-paid labor is one of the things that was imposed upon the South Korean by the American investors who invested their capital and who owned most of the industry in South Korea, you see. So now there's a big hue and cry about banning clothing coming in from South Korea in order to protect the standard of living of the members of the Amalgamated Clothing Market. I'm not going to get anywhere. That kind of business. At the same time, J.P. Stevens in the South is protected by his government and by his government's laws against organization through Taft Hartley. You know, the Union Temple had won a number of elections from J.P. Stevens. This is a diversion, but it may be interesting. They won a number of elections, but Taft Hartley doesn't guarantee that unions who win an election will get a contract. All they say is that if you have a majority, you have the right to determine who the collective bargaining agent is. Well, they determine who the collective bargaining agent is, and they bargain, and they bargain, and they bargain, until they bargain into the goddamn ground. They bargain forever without giving them an agreement. And so in the process of bargaining, after you bargain 2 or 3 or 4 years, your membership begins to go through your freedom, things will disappear. And so you've got to go through the whole process again, another election. And then they have the right to call for a re-election, don't you see? And this is the merry-go-round, this is the Taft Hartley merry-go-round to which they have complied, which they comply. At any rate, this one way of the American capitalist class getting back some of the money that had grown to its Elijah and Wallace using foreign ships. And so the American Merchant Marine was permitted to actually go out of business, with the exception of intercoastal ships and coastwise shipping and shipping of that kind that had few tankers. But in 1936 they decided they needed a merchant marine. Why? Because in 1936 they knew the war was coming. See, and they conceived of the Merchant Marine Act of 1936 and the building of the ships then as a supplement to the Navy. See. And they militarized it from the very beginning. Joseph Kennedy, the father of Jack, Robert, and Edward Kennedy, the Vice King of that time, he became the head of the first Maritime Commission. And along with everything else they enacted, in the middle of the strike, a section of the Merchant Marine Act which called for all seamen carrying a continuous discharge book, a book in which your record of employment and discharges are having to be carried with you every time you sign on for a shipping commission. Seamen have to sign on for every voyage for a shipping commission, and they have to show their papers, and this is what they were going to be employed to do. Discharge book was not new. When the union had its strength, and when the employers took over the hiring calls, they imposed upon the union to be with discharge book. That was one of the devices which they used to move out the union men, or union organizers, or troublemakers, you know, troublemakers. Of all the ships, who used to be with discharge book, or they had to move them to work, and see if they're fired. Thank you. what? You can't stop the government if you don't talk to your country. The human master of the world is the other thing that we can do.
Why do you have to take part in the government? tonight and thought that's why you fight. You can listen. You don't have to do that. But that's what happened to you all. And you need to be able to ask me to help a lot of people. I'm not allowed to do that. 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 I'm not allowed
I'm going to go to the next one.
adopted that positive Christian religion. One of them was that the people who come to office more than the money is Christ. Or even the money is Christ. And then you have to go back to the point of production. He said, that is the place of prevention of your confession. You know, what is it? Are you doing? When they found that the offices were closed, they were very small and select group. There's nobody in there with your confession. You cannot. You don't have your confession by eyes of all the confession. All that is just left for a while.
Get out on our own, you know, the problem. None of these people
in the running. Running is not about fighting, it's not about fighting that affected the action of men. In the course of fighting, we are members of tens of thousands. And that thing is not for the following of the world, or the power of men to do something fire, and we must fight the fight, we must fight the fight. And the only thing that we can ever do is to do the fight. For example, that's the job, and we must try to be out of the world, and we must be in the world. And so we are
Thank you.